Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Thank you for returning after lunch so promptly. And now we are ready for our third and final speaker of this event in the lecture series. I think time to get to Ralph Cavanna instantly so that he can use as much time as possible. Ralph.
And the format here is that after my brief remarks, Mike Peavy will comment as he wishes. Then we'll turn it over to all of you. And I think Alan and I have agreed that it's okay also for some of you, just raise your hand and feel free to speak out. And I want you to have a chance to think about that before we begin. I am going to begin my remarks, and what I'm going to try to do is to give a final historical perspective on California's contribution to overcoming pervasive barriers to energy efficiency, which surfaced repeatedly this morning, talk about how it was done, who was responsible, and also some of the bumps in the road, because it wasn't a seamless transition, and we also, I think, can learn a lot from what, from time to time, went wrong. I'm going to begin by doing something, as I said, that I never do. I want to read to you something that someone else wrote, and normally a long quotation is the worst way to begin an address, but I think this one will hold your interest, in part because I believe it is the first extended treatment of energy efficiency by any regulatory body in the United States. What you don't know is when it was and who wrote it, and I'm going to tell you that, but I want you to begin just by listening to how the issue was framed. We regard conservation as the most important task facing utilities today. Continued growth of energy consumption at the rates we've known in the past would mean even higher rates for customers, multi-billion dollar capital requirements for utilities, and unchecked proliferation of power plants. Energy growth of these proportions is simply not sustainable, nor is it necessary in order to achieve overall economic growth and full employment. Reducing energy growth in an orderly, intelligent manner is the only long-term solution to the energy crisis. At present, the financial incentives for utilities are all for increased sales, not for conservation. Whatever conservation efforts utilities undertake are the result of good citizenship rather than profit motivation. We applaud those efforts, but we think the task will be better accomplished if financial and civic motivations are not at cross purposes. And then finally, the effort we expect of our utilities is not limited to exhortation, advertising, and traditional means of promoting conservation. We expect utilities to explore all possible cost-effective means of conservation, including intensive advisory programs directed at large consumers, conservation-oriented research and development, and subsidy programs for capital-intensive conservation measures. There, in some sense, it all is. In terms of an understanding of the problem in whole, what needed to be done to fix it, what some of the major tools would be. And that is an opinion by the California Public Utilities Commission by 3-2 vote, September of 1975, written by Commissioner Leonard Ross, who Amory mentioned and went on to co-author a major paper with. Tragically, Commissioner Leonard Ross isn't here with us, isn't with us anymore. But that initial act moved under his leadership and under a bipartisan consensus that he assembled, because this was at a moment of transmission, a transition between the Ronald Reagan PUC and the Jerry Brown PUC. There's an interesting transition. And majorities had to be assembled of both kinds of commissioners. By December of 1975, the Public Utilities Commission had a conservation staff. That was the moment at which Rosenfeld and Goldstein were making their presentation to the CEC. Remember, Art showed you earlier on energy needs in California. By 1978, Leonard Ross had solved the problem of the linkage between utilities' financial health and their energy sales by designing a natural gas decoupling measure. And the term decoupling has been used in different ways this morning. I use it to mean simple regular adjustments in rates of a very modest size that basically make sure that utilities' ability to recover their fixed costs isn't affected by unexpected fluctuations in sales. It's breaking the link between utilities' financial health and increased sales. Ross had a mechanism in place to do that for natural gas utilities by 1978. And then when John Bryson came to the California Public Utilities Commission as its president in January of 1979, he quickly seized the first opportunity to move Ross's innovation over to the electric side so that California utilities, by 1981, had a full opportunity to invest in energy efficiency without being afraid that it would in any way harm the financial health of the enterprise. The first testimony describing this linkage between electric decoupling and energy efficiency was filed with the California Public Utilities Commission in April of 1981. I have presented this testimony with the permission of the author to the University of California Energy Efficiency Center at Davis. And this testimony was authored by Bill Marcus, a guy who's still very much around, sends you all his best, sent us the testimony. His attorney, in representing him before the Public Utilities Commission in April of 1981, was a young woman named Diane Grunick, who is also well known to many in this room, who is now a commissioner on the Public Utilities Commission. By 1981, therefore, much of the essential architecture for energy efficiency is in place in terms of utility efforts, and there's also a full understanding of the linkage and the importance of coordination between utility investment in energy efficiency and the efficiency standards for buildings and equipment that Art talked about at some length. There is an integrated effort to link up the efficiency programs with the standards, to use both to break through the worst of the barriers that prevent inexpensive efficiency from simply emerging in the marketplace. What California understood from the mid-70s is that energy prices alone would not come close to tapping all of the low-cost efficiency available, and that a coordinated combination of incentives and standards was the best way to do it. All of that architecture was in place early on, but then it is important for me also to emphasize that things didn't always go smoothly. To illustrate this, by the mid-80s, as a result of the work of Bryson, of Ross, of many in this room, of concerted efforts by the utilities, if you look for the period just 84 to 86, mid-80s, California utilities are out there doing a lot. Just in that three-year period, it looks to me from the record I can see that California utilities reached into roughly one out of every five California households, for example, in terms of energy efficiency improvements. They reached fully 1.5 million households, and that's just the investor-owned utilities. They reached 63,000 businesses. By 1985, the cumulative impact of the utility conservation programs was estimated by the Energy Commission at on the order of $840 million per year in reduced energy bills associated with that effort to go out and get all cost-effective energy efficiency, the goal that Lenny Ross first enunciated in 1975, that by then was at the core of what the utilities were trying to do, and they were pursuing energy efficiency, remember, as a resource for their systems, as the equivalent of a power plant. They were doing it at a scale that was larger. Only one other region even rivaled them, which was the Pacific Northwest. But then, by 1988, there had been a dramatic reduction in effort across California. This dramatic reduction, and the next document I want to bring to your attention, which I think is just one of several I want to illustrate by way of tracing the history of energy efficiency in California, it's a report which I'm betting Mike Peavy remembers. It was written by a 24-year-old intern at the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's called "The Decline of Conservation at California Utilities: Causes, Costs, and Remedies." When this report came out, the Los Angeles Times called then Southern California Edison president Michael Peavy, who responded with righteous indignation at any suggestion that the Southern California Edison Company was anything but assiduously diligent in the pursuit of energy efficiency. And yet, as I think Mike would concede today, 20 years later, the evidence was unmistakable. The three investor-owned utilities had cut their energy efficiency budgets by more than 50% by 1988 from the 1984 peak. And even more important, the level of savings was down by more than half. By 1988, the total savings from all of the California utility programs in aggregate was about one-third of 1% of annual consumption for that year, a figure well below previous efforts and, as we will get to in a moment, well below current efforts. So there had been a significant decline in investment, and it was clear in looking at it, and this was a point that Caldwell made in his report, that one of the contributing factors was that although Lenny Ross and his colleagues had understood very well the importance of ensuring cost recovery for utility investment in energy efficiency, although they had understood very well that you had to make sure that energy efficiency didn't actually hurt shareholders by impairing utilities' financial health, what they had not done was to respond to an invitation that actually the Environmental Defense Fund, as I think Joe Browder mentioned, Environmental Defense Fund had issued an invitation to the California PUC in the mid-70s. I believe Rosenfeld and Goldstein were expert witnesses in the proceeding, that there ought to be an earnings opportunity associated with energy efficiency if it really were to become a durable part of the utility's business model. The response of the Ross-era commission appears to have been that cost recovery alone would be enough because power plants were such a lousy investment for the utilities that even if they couldn't earn on energy efficiency, at least they'd be losing money less quickly. Someone, a cynic, later referred to this as the management philosophy of the flogging will continue until morale improves. And it didn't work uniformly well. By the mid-80s, with no earnings opportunity and with plenty of earnings opportunity associated with other more supply-side-oriented investments, utility attention had waned, management attention had waned. And what the California PUC did in 1989, captured by a headline, PUC backs energy savings. This is from the front page of the Chronicle, July of 1989. It's recounting a hearing in which the California PUC did something that I think exemplifies the best of regulatory leadership in California. Regulators elsewhere in the country, when faced with a controversial issue, like what do we do about conservation when there's been a dramatic reduction in momentum, and how do we fix a major resource acquisition problem, they have a tendency to look out at the stakeholders who contend before them and say, why don't you go out and find a consensus solution and bring it back to us? And if that's all you do as a regulator, without providing any guidance to the contending stakeholders, what you will likely get is more contention, or a least common denominator set of proposals that don't move you very far. California regulators, and I think this is fair to say this is true of both the Energy Commission and the PUC, have made plenty of use of negotiated settlements and collaboration, but they do so in the context of clear guidance to the parties. So in July of 89, the California PUC did not say, contentious parties, go out and find a consensus-based solution. They said, we are going to give you some guidance. We want you to bring back proposals on dramatic expansion of energy efficiency investment. We want you to bring back proposals on how to give utilities a performance-based earnings opportunity for energy efficiency. And if you don't come back with consensus-based proposals, we will impose our own best thinking on all of you. And with that kind of encouragement, you are able to get some very disparate parties to come together on very detailed proposals for making things better. And this is the June 1990 Energy Efficiency Blueprint for California, which some people in this room contributed to, which one of Mike Peavy's and my good friends, John Phillips, is signed on to. John, too, tragically not with us today. But this made possible a major move forward in energy efficiency, restoration of momentum in 1990, and it made possible the nation's first incentives for energy efficiency with the innovative feature that they weren't based on how much money you spent, which is the way that utilities had traditionally been rewarded for other parts of the business. They were based on how much money you saved your customers, and they were based on letting utilities keep a share of those savings. That shared savings formula became the basis for moving incentives for energy efficiency forward across the country in the early 90s. Then there was another major hiccup in the mid-1990s, which Joe Browder referred to in his remarks. He said, you brought us deregulation, California. And he said it in an accusatory way, and he was right to be accusatory. But what I want to emphasize is to cheer Joe up and all the rest of you is that California was not content with bringing us deregulation. There was a failed experiment that stopped conservation momentum and stopped momentum in every other kind of resource investment for the simple reason that the whole heart of the deregulation restructuring ideology of that era was that we didn't need utilities to invest in resources for us anymore, whether energy efficiency or any other kind. In the memorable phrase of the California PUC of that era, the genius of the marketplace would do that for us. Well, the genius of the marketplace promptly flunked its midterm examinations, as all of you recall. And what I need most to emphasize to Joe is that in California, and I think nationally, lessons were enduringly learned from the failure of restructuring. California has reconstructed now, in statute and regulation, a durable mechanism that, again, and here are the key features of what we have, what Lenny Ross understood in 1975, what is now enduringly part of California law and regulation. Energy efficiency is a resource for utilities, just like a power plant. Utilities are restored to their role as resource portfolio managers for their power systems. The goal is all cost-effective energy efficiency. We will maintain for all of our investor-owned utilities, both electricity and natural gas, systems of decoupling that break the link between their financial health and sales. We will use energy efficiency investment programs and integrate them with efficiency standards to maximize progress and to accelerate efficiency improvement. We will use incentives and decoupling both. We will make sure that energy efficiency is an earnings center for utilities, not just, in Lenny Ross's phrase, a civic obligation, although, of course, it is both. And that leads us, and the good news is that this is a model for reorganizing the utility sector that is proving to be tremendously compelling across the country. Joe, I agree with you that we're not there yet, but I think that we'll get there probably without much help from Congress, because the one thing, I think the thing Joe needs to remember, he painted a bleak picture of the Congress of the United States today, which never met an energy resource it didn't like. That's basically the story of Congress for 35 years in the United States. The problem with Congress is it can't say no to anything. All of the above has been the Congress's resource and energy strategy for 35 years. The good news is that over on the utility side, which is where all the money is, as Joe points out, the federal government doesn't have any anymore. Over on the utility side, people actually are used to making tough decisions with limited budgets. You will hear both presidential candidates in the next 3 weeks give speeches which include a sentence, in one case more emphatic than the other, along the lines of, if you elect me, I will build you 30 nuclear power plants. But presidents don't build nuclear power plants. Utility systems have to build them, make investment decisions based on a principle of best buys first, which underpins the California resource procurement strategy and can equally effectively underpin resource procurement strategies around the country. And if you look at the state of energy efficiency today, and this is the note I want to close on, I don't want anyone here to think that the era we've all been fondly recalling of the mid-70s and early 80s was the golden age of energy efficiency in California. The golden age of energy efficiency in California is right now. And for those of you younger than the demographic average of the presenters here today, there was never a better time to get involved. And this time around, you'll find regulators with names like Jackie Fannin Steele, Diane Grunick, and Susan Kennedy. And the three people who are going to succeed me at NRDC, whose names are Audrey, Cheryl, and Devra, want me to point out to all of you that as those three regulators' names suggest, the demographic of energy efficiency in California today is quite different from the demographic of those who have been making presentations to you today. Keep that very much in mind. Keep in mind that the California utilities today, California, if you ask in a competition for the most effective investors in energy efficiency in the world, there's no question the gold, silver, and bronze go to the investor-owned utilities in California. I try to avoid picking a winner arbitrarily at any particular moment because I like them competing with each other. But they're all here, and they deserve enormous credit for that. You should know that as you look at the development of an energy efficiency infrastructure, which my colleagues at the California Clean Energy Fund see from a venture capitalist perspective, efficiency emerges as one of the hottest and most exciting clean tech opportunities. I saw this personally illustrated when I watched my colleagues at Chevron Energy Solutions, and I think Jim Davis figured out what was going on here. He was summoned to a business school, which I shall not name because it's an honorable rival of this one, but he was summoned to it because the young professor named Erica Plambeck, who was he's basically the clean tech guru for this business school, wanted an exciting clean tech company to present to her students, all of whom want to go into this sector, and she picked Chevron Energy Solutions. And I think that's pretty cool. She picked me to come in and follow up just to vouch for what they were saying because none of the students could believe that this was the face of Chevron, and I assured them that it was. You've got a business constituency in California that, in favor of energy efficiency, exemplified by my friends here from the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, which we never had in the earlier era. And all of this underscores the sense of confidence that I want to leave you with, that the roller coaster ride is over and we really are on an ascending curve today. There is one more source of confidence, though, and it lies in the introduction of the speaker who is going to comment on my remarks. So let me tell you this about Mike Peavy. When Mike Peavy put his name forward to become president of the California Public Utilities Commission, he gave a promise to the legislature, which I happened to be in the audience and heard. He said that I am coming to this job with the principal objective of establishing the strongest environmental legacy of anyone ever to serve on the California PUC. This was characteristic Mike Peavy understatement for those of you who know him. But you know something? I think it's fair and appropriate today to acknowledge that he has done it, and that everything we've been talking about today is an affirmation of that. And so I can't imagine anyone better qualified to point out what errors I may inadvertently have committed than President Michael Peavy of the California Public Utilities Commission, to whom the floor is now extended. Would you let him know how you feel about what he's accomplished in light of all that we've done today?
Well, thank you very much, Ralph, and it's very kind words that you've uttered, and I'm sure that there is an ulterior motive behind them.
I just want you to autograph the 1989 report.
I'm going to be brief. My God, taking us back to Lenny Ross. Some of you are old enough to remember Lenny Ross won the $64,000 question. You remember that TV show? There's a few in the audience. Then again, of course, he had a very tragic end, but he was, went to Harvard at 14 or something like that. Brilliant, brilliant.
Reed College.
Who's from Reed College? I can tell.
He's my roommate.
There you are. Okay. All right. Well, I stand corrected. I just assumed he went to Harvard. I do want to make one minor correction or observation on something that my colleague said. I don't think that California, no doubt, adopted a very flawed deregulation scheme, but it was not that scheme alone that thwarted energy efficiency for a period of time, because the providers that competed with the Edison Company and San Diego and PG&E often found that the customers that they had were particularly interested in energy efficiency, and that sometimes the product you offered to good-sized companies like Ralph's Grocery Chain or Macy's or so, and since I was in that business, I had that experience.
We were that business.
we're very appreciative of that. And so it wasn't per se that scheme and the marketplace and that caused that decline, but the so much as it was the whole context of the times, I think, that certainly had a very, very negative impact on many, many things, and it still has some residual effect. But I want to make a couple of other comments here, and that is the following: that if energy efficiency, and I obviously have been an incredible supporter of it, and when I came on the Public Utilities Commission, we did with the Energy Commission, and then the California Power Authority. Some of you may remember we had something called the California Power Authority, headed by David Freeman, who now is wearing his white hat and TV ads on Yes on 7, much to the chagrin of Ralph Cavan and myself and many others. David seemed to have strayed a bit from his environmental roots. But he headed the California Power Authority. But David Freeman, myself, Sonny McPeak, who at that time was active in the energy arena, and all before she became Secretary of Business, Transportation, and Housing, we got together and we pushed the energy action plan on the state of California, first in the Davis administration and then in the Schwarzenegger administration, and we set forth a priority list. We called it the loading order, you know, just to use some new terminology, a priority list on what the state ought to spend most of its energy on, and energy efficiency was overridingly clear the first one. At the time we did this, in 2003, David actually wanted to build 5,000 megawatts of peakers, can you believe it or not, which the rest of us looked upon with horror. But anyway, we set forth energy efficiency and then renewables and then transmission for the renewables and so forth, and then down at the further down was more conventional power plants, gas-fired power plants, no coal. And, of course, that policy, and particularly regarding no coal, became then enshrined in Senate Bill 1368 by Senator Parada, but it was actually, it started out as a PUC policy. And that 2003 Energy Action Plan was restated in 2005 and again in 2008, and then now it's become conventional wisdom. Well, I have to say that 5, 6, 8 years ago, I don't think that was the case at all. Now, most everybody agrees that energy efficiency is on the priority list. You see these Chevron ads, and they say, first thing you got to do is energy efficiencies, full page ads in the Wall Street Journal, and so forth. But I think that despite this kind of enthusiastic endorsement, and I'm sure everybody in this room feels this way, I have to ask the question, why have we proceeded a relatively bumpy road in California, but I think a secure road now, and I'll tell you why in a minute, but why have we been so ineffective most everywhere else in the country? I mean, that's the harsh reality, is that decoupling a great scheme that started at the PUC, and with John Bryson at the helm at the PUC and all, has been endorsed and adopted by a handful of states at best, right, in the whole United States.
Well, a huge national campaign right now, Mike, and we're up to 18, but that's not 50. With all of your help, it'll be more soon.
Yeah, no, but my point is, I mean, if this, you know, why has it been so slow? This is decoupling. This is step one on energy efficiency. Step two is to provide actual earnings on investments in energy efficiency. Now up to 18 states, maybe, in varying degrees of enthusiasm and so forth, fought by consumer advocates in almost every state.
Yeah.
Consumer advocates for energy efficiency. I mean, my point is, what an educational job still is to be done. You have the consumer advocates, the Cubs, these guys, sitting utility board, all these kind of things, fighting this. How successful have we been with the municipal utilities? Well, there's some, you know, nationwide I'm talking about now. I'm not talking about SMUD. SMUD has been pretty good. You know, it's almost negligible, if anything. And because they have a different economic model, and their economic model is to subsidize the general fund in the communities in which they serve, and so forth. So they're concerned about all this. At the Public Utilities Commission early this year, we adopted a true earning incentives for energy efficiency. But I have to tell you, in all candor, it's a hell of a struggle to get its acceptance by consumer groups like TURN. Advocacy groups within the commission, like ratepayer advocates, they are much more comfortable with the old command and control mechanism that we had in the 80s and earlier, ordering rather than incentivizing. My personal belief is if we do not incentivize, if we do not allow utilities to earn money on energy efficiency and be able to count on earning money on energy efficiency, therefore appealing to the Gordon Gekko in all of us, that you won't ever have it sustainable long term, that command and control is inadequate. But we're going to have this huge struggles over these matters over the next few years, particularly given the national economic catharsis we're going through right now and the desire to go back to more regulation, more controls, and to some extent that's necessary, but it's not going to remain in the financial sector. It spreads to other sectors. The only way to ensure long-term energy efficiency, in my opinion, is to allow utilities to earn on their investments in it. And yet I have, as the two gentlemen here know, sitting in the audience, we're struggling at the Public Utilities Commission today to decide if they ought to get anything for what they did in 2006 and 2007, with the whole apparatus, so much of it, being very negative in terms of that, and wanting to go back and move the goalposts, reinvent the measuring tip, all these kind of things. Does a light bulb, does a fluorescent really have 9 years of life, or does it have 6.8 or 6.6 or 6.4? And, you know, you get it all these, you know, how long is the refrigerator's lifetime? How much is it really? Is it 80% more efficient or 76% more efficient? You know, all these kind of things are the practical, down-in-the-trenches problems we have right now. We have NRDC has been incredible in being supportive of the policy thrusts that I've tried to bring about at the Public Utilities Commission in this area and in this very immediate proceeding. But it's it can be very, very frustrating. So I would just say we need this at the national level. Hopefully, we'll have an energy bill next year that will insist upon and require energy efficiency. you know, or it'll insist upon and require renewables and allow energy efficiency to count to satisfy the Southern Company, you know, and a couple of others in Washington, because that's what we're really talking about doing battle with here in many respects. But we need that kind of policy thrust, and we have it in this state. I think it'll continue in this state, but I'm not as sanguine as Ralph or others that we have the assurance that that will have really meaningful programs nationwide in the next 4 or 5 years. We need a hell of a kick in the to force that along. We'll have to see. That's my comment.
Alan, it's all yours.
It's not all mine. It's going to be mostly the audience from here on. So we're going to have an opportunity to, I hope, first take some written comments and questions, and then we'll open up the floor to some audible comments, I hope. I realize the point of Ralph's talk was to cover the past. He left me with a distinct impression that he believes all we need is more and better of the same. How about bold new directions in energy efficiency? Where do advanced metering and customer behavior fit in any bold vision?
And what I think is most heartening, the single thing I take the greatest joy in from watching Peavey and his colleagues and Rosenfeld and his colleagues at the Energy Commission, and by the way, just having Rosenfeld at the Energy Commission and Peavey at the Public Utilities Commission, for anyone who wants innovation and big ideas and energy efficiency, is really good news. They are not sitting on 30 years of laurels. They are constantly looking for newer and better ways to do it. If you look, I see Roland Risser in the audience who runs the PG&E programs. I was with on a panel with Roland as we were explaining to natural gas utilities how to run energy efficiency programs. And Roland's was the appropriately the model case for the really exciting new ways of doing it, as opposed to the good old-fashioned high-efficiency furnace rebates of the past. And I think anyone who wants to see the new face of energy efficiency in the United States has only to look briefly at what's emerging in California. You'll be tremendously heartened by it. You will see regulators and utility leaders who are emphatically not satisfied with what we might have been doing 5 or 10 or 20 years ago, even though some of that was, for its time, path-breaking, as Lovins suggested. Remember, PG&E gave Lovins and Rosenfeld essentially unlimited budgets to build the 10 most energy-efficient structures in the country, but that was 20 years ago now. So the attitude of never being satisfied is the right one. To Mike Peavy's skepticism and concern about how can we possibly get this done nationally as quickly as possible, all I would say about that is the desire for a federal mandate, and it will be renewed, I think, whoever's elected president, just because we'll do a lot better than the status quo either way on this issue. The desire, I mean, hegemony is always more efficient. But the fact is that these are decisions in terms of the structure of utility systems and the interaction with efficiency standards that have largely been determined at the state level for a century. So I think we have no choice but to engage there with all the impatience that Mike Peavy rightly personifies, even as we try to squeeze all we can out of the federal government, because all of us know we've got to do vastly better. We've got to get off the roller coaster. We've got to get everyone on the same page on energy efficiency. But I will say to you all, there's never been a better moment for it. And the optimistic note on which I want to leave you is, Mike, we've now got agreements. In the last 3 months, NRDC signed agreements with all four of the major utility trade associations, everybody from the Southern Company to the National Rural Electric Cooperatives Association, taking the California policy on energy efficiency, although we were very careful not to call it that, and internalizing it in a way that I'm hoping will make Mike feel a little better as he watches this roll out over the next several months.
Well, let me just comment briefly on the topic, too. I really truly believe that in this state alone, we have only picked a bit of the low-hanging fruit. There's so much more to be done, and so much more that can be done. And that's why the programs that we already have are just the starters. That's why I've been a very strong proponent of AMI, meter replacement, which we've approved now, which is ongoing in California. All the meters, old meters, would be taken out by 2012, and on the Edison system, on the San Diego system, on the PG&E system, gas as well as electric, because that is a necessary precursor to going to the next major step in energy efficiency, which is pricing the product a truer reflection of its cost during the 24-hour cycle. And so you have to have the meters to do that. You can't do it by exhortation. You have to tell the meters, and you have to send price signals and all that. And I got to tell you, it was not an easy thing to get the California utilities committed to wanting to do this. I mean, Ed Giles is sitting here. Ed Giles, myself, Bob Foster, when he was president of Edison, and I think Dan Richard, I drugged these guys to Rome to see what Enel was doing. Enel is the Italian utility, which has replaced 30 million meters in its system with new advanced meters, with the chip being produced by Echelon, a San Jose company, and with IBM, a U.S. company, being the system manager. Take these people, you know, and I don't mean this to be excessively negative, but there to see that this can be done. Why are we doing this in Italy and not in California? Now, they have somewhat different challenges. They have more theft problems and a lot of other things, but they had that system. And so now they all came back and they've embraced it in varying degrees, all embraced it. That's only one step. We're arguing about opt-in versus opt-out for large customers. Utilities are very reluctant to want to have the customers just opt out. They want them to opt in to all an array of other energy efficiency incentives and programs and what have you. And, you know, there's a reasonable people can differ on the right policies here, but, you know, it's complicated. And, you know, when you talk about signing these protocols, the National Gas Association and these other entities, or you're getting into these other states, I mean, we are, and what we're dealing with in California is so much more sophisticated than most any other venue here in the U.S. in this regard, that it gives you a sense both of the opportunities, but also how far one has to go.
As we move forward and look at how we're going to reduce total emissions, I think we have to look beyond just the utilities. And although both of you commented in the context of the regulated utilities mostly, and I think this question about new directions in energy efficiency was a little broader than that. How do we deal with the other uses of energy, which is mainly in California, transportation? Do you see any other any broad or new directions and initiatives there?
I'll begin. First of all, the reason I always like to talk about regulated utilities is because the wires and pipes of America's regulated utilities connect directly to more than half of the carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. economy. So it does make sense to talk about them. They are a critical part of this, and aligning their business models with success in energy efficiency, I think, is legitimately a critical part of what we need to do. But in the global context that the UC Davis Center on Energy Efficiency is required to think about, California also has a wonderful story to tell on the other big sectors, of course, transportation and petroleum. And there, I think you need look no further than the scoping plan under Assembly Bill 32, our global warming law, for a wonderful set of innovative ideas on what to do with both getting three big areas, better vehicles, better fuels with lower carbon content per unit of energy, and with the signing of Senate Bill 375 just in the last 2 weeks, California adds the third major piece to its policy toolkit, which is the innovation in land use that will align future patterns of development in ways to minimize transportation-related energy needs. So if I could suggest, Alan, I think we were already talking about this at lunchtime, a worthy successor to this conference is the roots of energy efficiency and policy innovation on the transportation and fuel side, which UC Davis has some credentials on as well. And I will acknowledge that I think California has just as powerful a story to tell there.
I agree with everything that Ralph said. I do think that SB 375 by Steinberg is the first very, very significant step in ushering in a new era in land use planning, with all the implications it has for transportation planning, too.
In fact, in one of our future events, we will be addressing transportation. And curiously, maybe I'll give the story away right now, but you can trace the roots of all of the EPA fuel economy standards, the famous CAFE standards, to the smog in Los Angeles, and how California was the first region to try to reduce smog and tailpipe emissions, which led to the information database and knowledge that allowed us, in the end, to regulate fuel economy in automobiles. But that's a teaser, if you wish. Let me give you a couple more questions, and they're beginning to flow in. Given the per capita energy growth now occurring in such large countries as China, India, and so on, what lessons, collaborative processes, and knowledge, technological, political, and commercial, are transferable and can provide greater impacts to future energy use? I think I've got that. I want you people to reply, but I also know there are some people in the audience.
Yes.
I won't name any names, but
Mark
Roland
Levine
Risser,
can come up and sit with us now.
We have several experts whom I am going to draw upon to comment on that. So, but first the discussant, speaker and discussant.
Therefore, just then briefly on behalf of NRDC's Beijing office, proud host of Commissioner Rosenfeld on more than one occasion, I think that the California solutions are scalable. Even more important, the Chinese believe that, which is why there is something called a China-U.S. Energy Efficiency Alliance, which is really a China-California Energy Efficiency Alliance, just among those in this room, which was launched with the help of California's major utilities, all of which just like the UC Center on Energy Efficiency, and which draws upon what I find Chinese visitors and our colleagues in Beijing particularly keen on is the California model of integrating incentives and efficiency standards to drive efficiencies to higher levels and to do it at the minimum possible cost. In China, there is also the driver of local air quality and local environmental benefit, which is even more important to them right now, given the really horrific conditions in many Chinese cities than it has been in a very highly motivated state like California. So from my perspective, everything that we are doing has profound implications for China, India, and other economies which are growing very rapidly now. And the even better news is that's clearly their view, too. But Levine, I think, look, Mark, why don't you come on up here where you've got a microphone and enlarge on this view.
I'm Mark Levine, and I work in China on energy efficiency and lead a group that does that. When I go to China, one of the first questions I hear is, tell us about what's going on in California. In fact, this morning during a break, I went up to Dan Sperling and I said, I need to know the latest information about what CARB is doing. Is the report out? I'm being forced, and it's fun, I don't mind, learn everything I can about what is done in California because I have questions I have to answer across the board. Let me give examples. Interestingly, though, in some areas, we're going to be learning from China. If I could make a general statement, there's no place in the world, and I include California in that, that has a greater interest in energy efficiency right now than China. It is astounding what the Chinese are doing in energy efficiency after not giving it very much attention from 2001 to 2005. They had given it enormous attention from 1980 to 2000, but then they decided that the markets would solve all their problems, and by 2005 they discovered that wasn't the case. By 2006 they were beginning to mobilize to address the problem. So let me make a couple of specific comments. In the area of building energy standards, we are going to introduce Title 24 to California to China, and China is going to introduce Title 24 plus. Now, I can't tell you how long that'll take because enforcement of building standards in China, there are four cities that have been successful, at least on paper. We don't know about reality, but that's a tough job. Title 24 plus means that the Chinese will measure the energy performance of buildings. they will likely set up standards that look both at efficiency and consumption, because there are lots of Chinese who don't turn on their air conditioners. If you've been to China, and I'll try not to talk too long, I could spend the rest of the day, careful. But if you go to China and you look at these big office buildings, you see room air conditioners in throughout. And you say, my God, that is inefficient. Well, it's inefficient, but it's low energy consuming because the Chinese don't turn them on very often. And that's why they have room air conditioners. They also have operable windows in these big buildings. So anyway, if you wait, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, California will be able to learn from China on saving energy in buildings. Now, that's an optimistic view. A pessimistic view is that we won't learn from them for 15 years, but we will learn from them. On auto fuel economy standards, I think you all know that, you know, we have to catch up with China and the rest of the world, and China isn't looking to us on auto fuel economy. On land use, this is exciting, and if California can move quickly on land use, China pays enormous attention, as I said in my first statement, to what we do here. And so if we can do this right, if we can make significant progress in designing land use to support reduced transportation demand, there's a chance that the Chinese will pick up on that as well. And if they do, they'll probably improve on it in certain areas and we'll learn from it. On industry, that's probably the area that they'll learn least from us because their industry is rather different from ours. But I would note, even on that subject, there's a strong contingent in China that wants to see energy-intensive industry decline and the kind of industry we have in California expand. For example, tomorrow we will have a meeting with CSEC, that's the China Energy Conservation Investment Corporation, which used to be a government arm and used to, in fact, organize all of the energy conservation investment in China, which was substantial. They're now a privatized company. They have billions of dollars, they say, to invest in innovative approaches to energy efficiency, technologies from which they can make money. They're already the fifth largest wind producer in China. They're the largest producer of waste to energy. And they're building these huge industrial parks, which they're dedicated to the proposition that those parks and the buildings in them will use very little energy. I'll just say one other thing.
Go ahead.
My own view on one thing about buildings is I have concern about the LEED standard as it relates to energy efficiency in buildings. And I have concern about the fact that we're trying to sell the Chinese in using our rating system for LEED, which I think works very poorly for energy in buildings. This is another case, and there are probably too many of them, where we export some of the things to other countries that really we'd rather, we'd be better if we didn't have them ourselves, much less export them. This is a personal opinion, but it's going to be a very big political battle in China, and here's why. The government has decided that it's going to put money into green buildings. It's going to make it exciting, enticing, and desirable for builders to build buildings that can be certified green. That being the case, it's terribly important that green really be green, and I think that's one of a number of issues. But the Chinese, as a final comment, you've all heard about the tremendous number of power plants they've been building. They don't want to do that. That is to say, the government doesn't want to do that. The private sector, if there's money to be made, they're going to try to make it. So you've got this interesting dynamic where the government really wants energy efficiency to happen. In fact, the government has gone around the entire country. It's chosen the 1,000 largest industrial enterprises. It's arranged that the president of each enterprise sign a document committing to reducing energy intensity by 15 or 20% in 5 years. And if they don't succeed, they don't get promoted, they don't get any bonuses, and they can, in fact, lose their jobs. So now I don't know if we could, well, California, you know, we might try that. Mike, are you up for that?
Yeah.
So that's a brief summary of what's going on in China. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Do we have any other comments, perhaps? Yes. So is that, I'm sorry, is that, I can't see in the light who that is. Roland, it's going, will you talk about India, Roland? Thank you.
I think Ralph might have mentioned that I would talk about India, and actually I got pulled into India, which is another developing country that has similar issues, by art, and actually there was a project with LBL and the U.S. government to help India with some of their energy needs. They have a little different situation than China in some ways, but in similar in some ways. One of the biggest challenges they have is they manage their supply-demand curve by just shutting off power. So there's a certain number of hours a day where they just shut off circuits, and it's a random lottery. That's if you your circuit gets shut off, you call the government and you complain, and you get yours on, and someone else goes off. So it's, and I was there when it was going on. So it's quite an interesting system. They haven't been able to build enough power plants, so they're all of a sudden very interested in energy efficiency. The regulator for the utilities in Mumbai, which is a big state in India, met with our Public Utilities Commission and were convinced that the California-style program was the appropriate way to go. And so they actually followed California and mandated that their utilities implement energy efficiency programs. LBNL was over there with me, and we actually helped them build their first programs. One thing I was going to point out to folks is whatever we think about our technologies and our programs, we need to understand they won't work by just walking in and trying to impose them upon another culture and country. So we did a lot of retrofitting of program elements to make them work with a different way of doing business. So what we were able to do is bring them great best practices and then revise them for what will work in a different country. The advantage they have is, like China, in many cases, the technologies they're using are several generations behind us. So they actually are leapfrogging over many of the things we've done, some of the mistakes we've made. So I think they actually have a huge opportunity to have great advancement with these efforts. Last point I was going to make is there's a new effort with ISO to build an energy management standard. And this energy management standard, the U.S. took the leadership role in this, but China's part of it, and several other, there's actually 26 countries are actively involved in this new energy management standard. And what's important about it is we're bringing California lessons to this standard. It starts with data. You need to know where you are to know where you're going. Second piece is you need a management commitment. If you don't have management commitment, it won't work. So we're bringing that, which we learned in California. And the third piece is we're saying you must have a commitment to continuous improvement. What we've learned in California is if you continuously build upon what you did, you can actually make significant improvements in the energy use of your facility. So those are the elements of the standard. We expect it to be available by 2011, and it's international process is complicated, the negotiations are difficult, but these are some elements that where California is bringing knowledge that will make a big difference internationally.
I wanted to make a couple of comments about India and China. First of all, I want to praise Roland Risser, who spent a week in Mumbai, and shortly thereafterwards, the regulator in Mumbai told the Mumbai Utilities to initiate their first $22 million a year public goods charge program and ordered all the intersections in Mumbai, all the large intersections, to go to LED traffic lights. All good things, bless you, Roland. I was in China with Diane Grunick and John Wellinghoff from FERC a few months ago, and learned a couple of interesting things, which Mark didn't say about enlightened policies, electric policies. They are very keen on the word best practices. They grade their, incidentally in China, electricity, unlike the United States where 80% goes, 70% goes to buildings, in China, industry gobbles up, I think, what, two-thirds of the electricity. They keep track of the energy efficiency of their industries. They take the worst, roughly one quarter, and as a incentive to improve their energy efficiency, they double their electricity rates, and the firms go out of business. And it's a very effective way of managing energy efficiency. They also do something which we haven't learned to do in California yet. Their auction for power as it varies during the day, as they pick up new generation as the load goes on during the day, they take into account externalities. So in California, first cost is what gets you onto the grid. In China, they don't have any very clean power plants, but they have a lot of very dirty ones. They rate the efficiency of every power plant, and they have environmental dispatch, and they take on the cleanest power plants first and the dirtier power plants later, and it's not done on first cost. So they're actually ahead of us there. I thought that was sort of interesting. Diane Gernick and I going back to India in March 1st to 10th and going to try to sell the energy efficiency idea and public goods charges to a whole bunch of Indian utilities. And we hope Roland will come. Thanks.
Are there any other comments, sir?
I'm Ed Giles. I know most of you. A couple of comments on just thinking about where we are as a country and some local thoughts and observations. As Mike mentioned, I have been very actively involved in promoting the new metering concept. An interesting observation on behavior of customers over the last several years, at least in our service territory. Customer growth has dropped off dramatically. However, the use per customer has continued to increase. And it's just an observation I would throw out to the group now. A couple of things. Certainly, we've seen a movement toward more single-family dwellings, and we've seen a movement toward people having more plasma TVs, more gadgets of all kind, so that as we think about energy efficiency going forward, we need to think about what's changed in the homes where people exist and how they use their energy. And for years, the use per customer was flat to declining, but it is now gone in a positive direction. So that's just one point I would throw out for people to ponder as we think about how to improve energy efficiency. But the other comment I want to make, and it comes back to my concern about energy policy at the countrywide level. And when I was running the utilities, I had one point of view as it relates to approaching energy efficiency and the energy policy that Mike and others have so brilliantly provided leadership for. But as I travel around the country in my current job and look at other utilities and we think about applying the energy policy of our state in other states, there's a couple of things we got to deal with first. I look at other utilities, they don't have the fundamental regulatory construct before you think about decoupling to look forward in terms of how they deal with rate cases. And that's one of the fundamental issues that's got to be dealt with. When I look at many of the other utilities, they are at risk for sales, and they don't have a forward-looking rate case test cycle. And so the guys running the utilities are thinking about earnings in the short term, and the regulators that are regulating them don't want to take on the issue of decoupling because they're afraid of it. And so the utilities are constantly put in this conundrum where they don't want to go in for a rate case because they fear they'll get whacked. And at the same time, they're not going to make any progress on energy efficiency unless they can have their rates decoupled and therefore then apply the loading order that we've already begun applying in California. So, I mean, just those are just a couple of observations. This is particularly prevalent in the Southeast, where I've done some traveling and looking around.
Yeah.
And it's a conundrum, because I firmly believe for the country we need the energy policy that first allows decoupling and then apply the loading order so that energy efficiency become motivational on the part of customers and the utilities and the regulators. But we got to start with that step prior to the decoupling, as I see it.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make, I'm sure that we would all agree with what Ed has just said on the, his latter point. I want to make a point, two observations on the first point. We've all heard of, you know, the, and we put it in every publication you ever see in energy efficiency today, the Art Rosenfeld chart that shows aggregate per capita electricity use in California per capita staying constant for 30 years while the nation as a
whole. We showed it earlier.
So. Yes, we've all seen it. But to Ed's point, this is a sophisticated group. When you disaggregate those numbers, which I started to do at the PUC and stopped, when you disaggregate those numbers, you find that residentially, it's not flat. It's doing just what he said. It's going up. And it's going up steadily for all the reasons we said, because we have to have that TV. We get instant gratification. We press the button, and 3 seconds, it's on, rather than waiting like I did when I was a kid to have to wait 30 seconds for the TV to come on. Oh, my God, we can't have that anymore. And all our other stuff are on even when they're off, you know, all of our other appliances. So it's very troubling when you actually disaggregate the numbers and then couple it with where the new housing is being built. In California, Central Valley, San Bernardino, Riverside counties, and so forth. Now, that's why you have to see this all in a very holistic way. That's why something like SB 375, that has land use consequences in terms of housing and development, is another arrow to be fired or shot in terms of climate change, greenhouse gases, energy efficiency. It's fundamental. That's point one. Second point is, when you also look at those overall numbers in California, and you break out the municipal utilities from the investor-owned utilities. The investor-owned utilities, for all the reasons that Ralph has indicated, going back to Lenny Ross, the per capita numbers are far better than they are for the municipal utilities, by a gap of maybe 20% to 30%. Just another observation. We have those municipal are supposed to be the citizens, the people's utilities, right? You know, owned and managed at the local level by the local elected officials, blah, 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 blah. They ain't worth shit. In terms of this effort, changing the inducements and the incentives for them, they aren't going to do as well as the investor-owned if you give the investor-owned a chance to earn some money on it. Not just decoupling, that's the first step. You have to actually earn money on it, versus the munis, which have a different basis. And I just close on that point by remembering two phone calls I had back in the height of the energy crisis from the then mayor of Los Angeles, Richard Reardon. Mike, why isn't David Freeman getting every last penny he can get in sales of electricity to Edison and others? By God, you know, I mean, because I was reasonably close to Reardon, he'd asked me to head DWP, which I fortunately did not do. But I mean, he couldn't understand. He said, doesn't David and everyone understand that this will give us another $100 million this year in the coffers of the city of Los Angeles, and I could have another 300 or whatever it was policemen on the streets for that. Now, that's a different incentive system. I mean, you know, you have to realize that. It's not necessarily wrong. If public safety is number one for the city of Los Angeles, you want to have more police. But it runs counter to some other needs. And until we change some of those incentives for the munis, which we've started to do in a very creepy-like fashion legislatively in California, we're not going to get an even playing field for energy efficiency munis versus IOUs.
I'd like to get one more question that was more relevant to what Ed said and then also Mike said. If we need to limit carbon emissions in the future, then we'll need to limit total consumption. Can we do it all with energy efficiency or increasing energy efficiency?
And, of course, Mike has an order pending that, for the first time, will begin to, in detail, work out how serious carbon constraints will be put in place across the entire utility sector. But I think the right answer to that question is to remind us all, and this is a good note maybe on which to close, that I think the genius of the California system has not been to either say all of the above, as the Congress has mindlessly done, as I've argued for 35 years, or to dictate who the winners will be. The genius of the California system has basically been to set up a structure that lets the winners and losers emerge on the merits, subject to insisting that energy efficiency goes head-to-head against all other forms of supply, that the state objective is all cost-effective energy efficiency, and that then within whatever environmental constraint you supply, like a carbon constraint, you look for the lowest cost opportunity in the overall context of a balanced portfolio, and you maintain a strong utility role, although, as Mike says, not necessarily an exclusive one, in making decisions about what resources to acquire. So for someone like, if you asked the question in California or the Pacific Northwest over the last quarter century, what were the big winners in energy technology? I mean, no mystery. For the two regions that took energy efficiency most seriously, energy efficiency was the huge winner. There was exactly no new coal. There was exactly no new nuclear. And there were significant investments in both high-efficiency natural gas and renewables. And if I were a betting person, I'd think that that's likely to continue going forward. But I think the important thing is not to dictate it. Set up a system that really lets innovation drive the lowest-cost ways of meeting the environmental objective. That's what we've been good at. Stay out of the all-of-the-above fallacy by insisting on genuine merit driving decisions as opposed to some kind of artificially constrained sense of the options going in. And if that may well end up being the most durable and appealing contribution that California energy policy has made.
Thank you.
Just a brief comment. I agree with what Ralph has said, but one also has to have an acute appreciation of the fact that if you leave this solely to this, and I agree with you about all of the above is not a very desirable, although it may be a necessary or only thing that we end up having, but. Remember, California has got it's the world's eighth biggest economy if it stood alone.
No, we're number 10 now. French passed us again.
Well, these are based on exchange rate variations. I mean, very frankly, sometimes it's 6 to 10. Well, it's big. 38 million people. Public Utilities Commission, we have 1,000 employees. The Energy Commission has how many employees? 400. So 1,400 employees there, not even before we got to the ARB and AB 32 and all that. And then you go to half the states in the United States that have fewer people than San Diego County. And they don't have the infrastructure to do these things. They're not equipped to. They don't have the infrastructure. The utilities tend to be dominant. And it's very difficult to spread the same kind of knowledge to places that don't have the ability to deliver on it and are just, even forgetting blue and versus red states, because I think you're going to see a significant change in what's defined as blue states in 3 weeks from today. But I certainly hope so anyway. But putting that aside, it's just the infrastructure is not there to do this. And I don't know how we're going to get over that. I mean, Oregon and Washington, to some extent, yes, Oregon and Washington bought the California kind of program, so is British Columbia.
So has Idaho,
yes,
which has no public sector to speak of, but has a big, competent utility, which, when put under the PV system of incentives, actually can deliver.
I hope you're right.
Idaho.
I hope you're right, because the chair of NARUC this year is from Idaho, and I have not seen a discernible spread of that passion within the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. Well, maybe it's a little sub rosa. But in any case, my point is simply that you could do some things on the scale that this state is, that it's much, much tougher when you go to all these much smaller places. I hope Ralph's right on this with Idaho.
All right, thank you. You know, I had a well, one of my best friends has been joking about this lecture series for a while. He says, "You still dealing with that old fogies lecture series?" And I have to sort of say, yes, I'm still dealing with the old fogies. And the fact of the matter is, I guess I'm stunned because when I start listening to some of these people speak, they can still remember what those assembly bill numbers were, and I can't remember what they are today, and yet they are still coming up with the recollections. And in fact, these people still are founts of wisdom, which I am just pleased to tap, both to understand what happened in the past, but also apply to the future. And what surprised me about this whole group of lectures was to see how far back some of the ideas for energy efficiency started. I like to think when I started organizing this that Warner Alquist was sort of the prehistoric and Stone Age and maybe...
some of the people...
Fortunately, the microphone is not collecting Gene Veronini's comments here. But what I found was, in fact, no, that was actually just the culmination of a whole stage of events that started with Bob Foster punching a hole through his walls here in Davis. And leading to certainly the most innovative energy efficiency regulation of that time, and still maintains a kind of a degree of innovation that I don't think exists elsewhere. Although, as Mark Levine pointed out, the Chinese are not only copying, but they are refining and improving, and maybe someday we'll be importing their ideas. We also saw how there was this surprisingly strange collection of bedfellows working together, the environmentalists, the analysts, the Public Utilities Commission, and the scientists. And in the case, as Art described, we saw this kind of symbiotic relationship developing between the scientists who are developing new tools to understand energy use and to create technologies to reduce energy consumption, and the regulators in Sacramento and in San Francisco and elsewhere trying to figure out how to make the regulations to do it. But at the same time, we also realized that it was essential to make energy efficiency financially attractive to the players, and that I think applied then, it applies now, and that's going to apply, of course, in the future as we try to make this right-hand turn again on energy consumption. I thought that what Ralph said, that the golden age of energy efficiency is right now, is certainly appropriate, and we should take that into consideration, because we're actually signaling for that turn right now to move down and try to figure out how to move our complete energy consumption patterns in a different path than we have been for the last 30 years, and possibly leading the whole state. Several people asked were asking, well, why did it happen in California? And we've reflected on it, and I guess. There's a way of distilling it that California imports wackos and exports ideas, and maybe that's what's happening. We somehow have a culture here that's brewing and fermenting, and several other kinds of chemical reactions are occurring at the same time, and out comes some surprisingly strange and innovative and sometimes successful ideas, and energy efficiency seems to be one of those. So what I want to do now is two things. I want to first thank a lot of people who participated in this. I want to thank the discussants, the moderators, the panelists, and you, the audience. Chevron helped sponsor this, and I also want to mention specifically Russ Yarrow, Diana Bauman, and Jim Davis for their help. And there's a staff who's been circulating in the background which has actually made this thing happen, namely Gwynne Benner, Stephanie Timmons, and Blake Finnegan, all of the Energy Efficiency Center. So I want to thank everybody for attending. So I would like to give you a hand right now.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.